I'm Drew. I'm an alcoholic. And I have a sobriety date. It's July 16th of 2014. I have a home group, as just mentioned, Happy Hour in Allentown. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I still talk to him on a regular basis. I've been through the 12 steps as outlined in the big book, and I've had the honor and privilege of taking other people through it as well. And, you know, it's funny. I used to come around here probably like 2009, 2010, and there was one guy who's a home group member who's not here tonight, and he always used to tell me, you know, you're so selfish and self-centered. Until you do something about that, you're going to continue to hurt everybody in your entire life. And I was like, yeah, all right, F you, you know. And what ended up happening is I went back out, I ended up in jail, and here I am again, you know. So I guess he was right. You know, I guess it's my job just to say, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I will mention dry goods are a major part of my story. I won't talk about them out of respect for AA. However, just to let you know, like, I've pretty much been addicted to anything you can get addicted to. And I got sober in AA. So if it works for me, it can work for other people. I was born in Abington, Pennsylvania. And my mom and dad are still married to this day. We married 35 years in April. I was pretty much given everything I needed and most of the stuff that I wanted. I had a great childhood, and that has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, early on, I guess the best way that I've ever heard it described is, you know, as a child, I thought there was, like, something different about me, right? And the best way I've ever heard it described is that, you know, upon birth, everyone's given this guidebook to life, you know, but mine got lost in the mail, so I had no idea what I'm supposed to be doing. So everyone else is going along living their life because they have some idea of what they're supposed to do, and I'm just running around mimicking everybody else because I'm really uncertain as to what I'm supposed to be doing. And when I was in second grade, I had to take an IQ test, and as a result of that, I was put in the gifted program, and that helped to make me feel even more out of place, you know, because here I am, second grade, doing cryptograms while other kids are learning addition. You know, it was pretty strange. And you know, as time went on, you know, I felt like a stronger disconnect with people, you know. As I matured, other people started acting different ways, and, like, I had to change the person that I was to fit in with whatever group I was currently in. And I think when I was 10 years old, my younger sister was diagnosed with cancer, right? And I was, like, baptized Episcopalian but raised Catholic, so I was kind of confused from the beginning. And once this happened, I was like, man, there can't be a God. You know, like, how's God going to give a two-year-old kid who never had a chance to live, you know, like, this possibly fatal disease? You know, like, how could a God do that? So that was kind of like my riff with God, you know. So as time went on, you know, I did really well in school. And in middle school, I was selected. I was supposed to take the SATs. And, you know, I was so nervous and fearful about how other people would view me and the fact that I'd be labeled like a dork. I didn't do it. You know, I didn't do it. I couldn't do it. So full of fear. And shortly after that, my dad got a new job in Bethlehem, and the family relocated. And, you know, we moved up there, and, like, I don't know if it's teenage angst or, you know, or in my case, I'm pretty sure it was, you know, I was a dehydrated alcoholic. You know, I just had to add the alcohol, and, you know, I was off. But, you know, I came up here, and I decided to reinvent myself and be a completely different person. So I went from being an introvert who rarely spoke to an extrovert who just said whatever was on his mind. And, you know, at the age of 14, that's when I first picked up alcohol intentionally. And, you know, what happened, I can still remember to this day exactly the situation where I was at, who I was with. And that shows me it was a pretty impactful moment in my life, you know, for me to still be able to recall that. And, what happened is me and two of my friends went around the neighborhood. We stole a case of beer. There's three of us. Case is 24, so we each got eight. I think it was 120 pounds at the time. I drank my eight, and I tried to steal theirs. And I remember laying back on a beanbag chair and staring at the ceiling. It was spinning, right? And I was thinking to myself, like, man, if I could just feel like this for the rest of my life. You know, because once I put that drink into me, like, all those thoughts about how I should act and how I should be around people, that stuff went out the window, and I just did whatever I wanted, you know. And I figured if I could just live like that, everything would be great. And, also that night, I realized that when I was 10 years old, I had been drunk before, and it wasn't intentional. One of the neighbors had, like, a picnic, and they had Jell-O shots, but I was a kid. Like, I didn't know it was Jell-O shots. I thought it was just Jell-O, so I ate, like, 5 of them. And I remember having that same feeling going down the sliding board, like, what the hell is wrong with me, you know? So what ends up happening is, you know, throughout, like, middle school and high school, well, throughout high school, I didn't really have any, like, legal consequences, right? But what happened is my grades fell significantly. And, significantly enough that my parents took notice, but they thought it was just, like, a phase and that I would grow out of it. And, the one thing that I can relate it to is, I heard this quote once is, what do you call the guy that graduates last from medical school?
Doctor.
Exactly, doctor. So why work hard if you don't have to? You know what I mean? I'm just going for this piece of paper. It doesn't matter how good I do. So I end up graduating high school, you know, no problems whatsoever. And, I apply to colleges, and I go to the first college that accepts me, and that happens to be Kutztown University right now. Kutztown is a dry campus. So if you drink like I drink, you should not go to a place that has a dry campus. They had a 3-strike drug and alcohol policy, and the second day of the second semester, I got my 4th strike. So, I pulled a Nixon and I resigned before I was impeached, and I moved home with mom and dad, and it was crazy. I graduated high school, and then within a year I got arrested 4 times, 2 for underage drinking and 2 for underage DUIs, but I didn't have a problem, you know. And so what happens after the first DUI is, my parents are like, maybe you should go to this counseling stuff, and I'm like, all right, I'll do that. You're letting me live at your house, I'll do that. So I go to this counselor, and she's telling me about these AA meetings, you know, and I'm like, all right, I'll go check one out, and I go, and, you know, this is just my perception at the time. I'm not saying this is how it really was, but this is how I perceived it, and I walk in, it looked like Bridge Club, you know. I'm like, what is going on here, you know, like 70-year-old men drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, and I was like, this ain't for me. So what I did is I learned enough people's names so that I could fill out the paper that I had to get signed, and I filled the paper out myself, and go figure, man, 6 months later, another DUI, and this time it was a little bit more serious. You know, it was a second underage DUI it was the day I was supposed to get off probation for my first one, and the PO let me slide, and she closed my case out, so I get this second DUI, and I'm still like, oh, no, you know, it's not me, like, I don't have a problem, it was just bad luck, I made a poor decision, and this time the lawyer's like, listen, like, if you don't go to rehab, you're going to go to jail. So I'm like, all right, I'll go to rehab, jail, rehab, you know, sounds like a good choice. So I go to rehab, and again, this is just my perception of things, right? But I look around the room, the next closest person to me is like 42 years old, and I'm like, you know, I'm 19 right now. I got like 23 more years until I got to do this, you know, so I do what I always do in life. I listen to the people that are seemingly doing well. I say the same things that they're saying and do the same thing that they're doing so I can get out on time. And I get out, and I think I made it like a month after that. And, it's ironic because I went to court, and even though I went to rehab, they still put me in jail. You know, apparently the fact that I had, you know, 2 underage DUIs within 6 months didn't please the judge too much. So he decided to make an example out of me. And, here I am sitting in jail. And I spent my 20th birthday in there. And I'm looking around at, like all these people that are, like, career criminals and stuff. And I'm like, that's it, man. I'm never coming back to jail. You know? I didn't say I would quit drinking or quit doing other things, but I wasn't going to come back to jail. And, I got out of jail with, I swore a solemn oath that I'm not going to drink or do anything else until I get off parole, right? And then I find out I'm on non-reporting parole, and I'm like, forget that, you know? So I go right back to what I know. And, in the interim, I had gotten a job working in a hospital, and I was a patient attendant pushing people around for the test, right? And, my parents were kind of nagging me on my back about going to college, getting a career, and all this stuff. And, so I made a great career decision, right? And that was, in a hospital, it's really warm in the winter, it's really cool in the summer, and there's women everywhere, right? So I'm going to be a nurse. So I go to school to be a nurse. And, I ended up, me and this girl, we move in together, and, I'm in nursing school, and, You know, I don't even know how these teachers don't know I have a problem. You know, I can't even stay awake in class. I'm drooling all over myself, throwing up in the parking lot. And for some reason, they don't seem to notice it's a problem. And you know, this girl I'm living with too, she's like naive. She has no idea. And you know, it comes to the end of school, and I graduate, and then I find out from the state of Pennsylvania that because I have these two DUIs, I have to go for an evaluation before I'm allowed to sit for the boards. So, you know, I go for this evaluation in front of these two PhDs, you know, and I do what I do best, and that's I lie. You know, I tell them, look, I was just a kid. I made poor decisions. You know, it was a rough point in my life. I'm going to do things differently from now on. Like, I don't even mess with that stuff anymore. You know, all the while, I'm so scared about having to go to this thing. I have to get intoxicated in order just to show up, you know, and for whatever reason, they believe me, and they allow me to sit for my boards. And you know, the girl I was with, she was pregnant. She just gotten pregnant. And I got a job working in a hospital. Like a month and a half later, I get called down in front of the nursing supervisor of the whole hospital. I'm like, man, this ain't good. And what had happened is somebody had called the hospital and reported me. And they called me down and they gave me a, you know, a drug test. And I thing lit up like a Christmas tree. And they told me I had to go to rehab yet again. And so I call this girl that I'm with, you know, who's pregnant at the time. I tell her, you know, I'm going to rehab. And, you know, I go to another rehab. It's actually the one I had gone to before, but this time it's in a different program. And, you know, I get there and it's the same thing. You know, like in my personal experience, every time I've been to rehab, they told me the same exact stuff. Right? And pretty much what it was is go to AA when you leave here. You know, and I was like, nah, I'm good. And so this time, you know, I go. And I end up getting transferred due to conflict of interest because there was someone else that worked in the same place that I did, so they split us apart. And they sent me to this rehab down in Bensalem. And on my 27th day, I get this really, really good idea, right? What that idea is that if I just sneak out in the middle of the night and I go to Kensington and I come back, no one will ever know, and by the time this whole nursing thing comes up and I get drug tested, like I'll be good, and I won't have to worry about it, right? So that's what I do. I go down there and I come back, and unfortunately, there's like a lot of instances in my life that at the time I thought they were really bad luck, but now I look at it, it was like God kind of kicking me in the ass, you know? But the one kid that was in the same room as me was outside talking on a cell phone that was with his girlfriend, and you're not allowed to have a cell phone there, so they tested everyone in the room, and of course I get caught. You know, I have this girlfriend at home who's 4 months pregnant who thinks I'm coming home, and my dad, who's on his way to pick me up, thinks he's taking me home, and he ends up having to pick me up and take me to another rehab in Williamsburg, Virginia. And you know, he just had that look, and I'm sure pretty much everyone in this room knows that look, like that look of just utter disgust. Like, what is wrong with you? Why can't you see that this is destroying your life? Like, why can't you do something about this? For the whole, like, 5.5-hour ride to Virginia, that's just how he looked at me. And you know, and that is, like, frothy emotional appeal. You know, that did nothing for me. Did nothing. You know, like, I really, if he had asked me why I did that, my answer would have been, I have no idea. It seemed like a good idea. And really, like, that's as truthful as I can be. But so I go to this rehab in Virginia, and this place is different than any other place I went. It was, like, a partial place, and they asked that you go to outside meetings at night, and you get a sponsor, and you start doing the steps. And so I go to a meeting, and I see this guy, and he raises his hand and says he's an alcoholic and also a recovering a-hole, you know, and I'm like, that guy sounds perfect. So I ask him, you know, and at the time I'm thinking, like, he's not going to make me do any of this stuff. Well, unfortunately, apparently, if you're an a-hole and you want to recover, you got to do the same stuff, you know? So we start going through the book, and they allow me a pass to come home for Christmas to see my family and the pregnant girlfriend. And I come up here and I go to a meeting outside of Hellertown. I run into the guy who's my sponsor now. You know, and he's one of those guys that always used to creep me out all happy and smiling. He's like, hey, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, man, I want to punch you in the throat, you know? But he gave me his number, and you know, I got in contact with him when I got back, and I continued to, you know, to do the work. And so what ends up happening is, you know, I get to the ninth step, and you know, I'm supposed to be making amends, and I make like two of like the soft ones that I know are going to go well, And after that, my life is looking pretty good externally. You know, like I got a good job again, everything's going along well. And I come to the conclusion that I don't have to do this stuff anymore. And then I get a really, really good idea, right? And what this really, really good idea is, and this is the only time I'll mention drugs, is that I know I can't do anything that's physically addicting, right? But acid is not physically addicting. So, you know, I plan I'm going to take acid, right? So like a normal person does when they go to get acid, I go and buy 2 10 strips, you know? And I take like 14 hits of acid over a 3-day period while working as a nurse taking care of dying people. You know, like, and at the time, that seemed perfectly reasonable to me. Like, what's wrong with that? If I can do it, why can't I? You know what I mean? Like, who are you to tell me that I can't function like this? Look at me, I'm doing great, no one knows. And, you know, what that did for me is that awakened it. You know, like, I'm not saying, like, well, I started taking acid every day, but what happened is, like, that voice in the back of my head came back, where it's like, you know, you can do this, you can do this. And, you know, and then I set out on the journey of only doing things on Friday, you know? And that lasted for a few Fridays, and then one day I woke up and it was Tuesday, and I was still intoxicated from Friday. And I got called for a urine that day for the state board, and, you know, I went and failed it, and failed another one 2 days later, and my nursing license was suspended indefinitely. You know, and then I'm like, oh, it's okay, because I picked up another profession in the interim that I was making decent money at. I was like, I'll just do this. And like 2 months later, I fall asleep on a roof plugging in a saw to do deck replacement, you know, and I get fired from that job. And, yeah, at this point, like, you know, my daughter had been born. Oh, I forgot this. You know, my daughter was born when I was 5 months sober. And a month after that, her mom, who I'd been with for like 5 years, is like, you know, I can't be with you anymore. And this is a girl who, like, the whole time we're together, she's like, I just want you to get clean, you know, and then I finally do, and she leaves, right? And so after about, you know, a year and a half, like, she was no longer allowing me to be a part of my daughter's life. And why that is because although I was abstaining from alcohol, I was still the same guy. You know, nothing had changed. And so, you know, she thought that I wasn't, you know, in a mental state to be a part of my daughter's life, and therefore I wasn't. So, you know, after all this stuff happens, you know, the next 3 years, it was just an absolute mess. You know, I ended up in situations I shouldn't have been in places I shouldn't have been in. You know, living in squalor, we'll say. And you know, the one day I go to give my younger brother a ride to the airport, and I go in the bathroom and I come out and he's blue on the front seat. He'd OD'd. And I start giving him CPR, and the cops come and they arrest me. This is right before they pass that Good Samaritan law, because I got luck like that, you know? And you know, I get charged for that. And then you know, before this keeps getting continued, this case, and my parents go on vacation for their wedding anniversary. Me and my brother have nowhere to live, so we decide to break into their house. And, you know, we break into their house, we're living there, we steal a bunch of money from them, and we run out of all the money that we stole from them. And then we remember that somebody owes my brother money, so we go to collect this. And we get to the people's house, we knock on the door. They say they don't have the money. We're like, all right, we're going to leave. My brother decides to turn the power off. And as we're driving down the street, the police come flying at me, try to T-bone me at the road, you know? And at this point, I have no idea what happened. It turns out, you know, the girl had called the police and said we tried to kick the door down and break in. So, you know, we get arrested and charged with a bunch of felonies. I tried to run from the police and got tased twice. That was a blast. And and I end up in jail, and me and my brother both. And, you know, my parents are out of the country. There's no way to get in contact with them. And, you know, look at this situation, it's like, man, like, you know, what did I get myself into? And, you know, you would think stuff like that would be enough, right? And, like, maybe a normal person, they would stop. But for me, I was like, yeah, this is even better reason to keep doing what I'm doing. And so I end up doing 2 months in jail. I end up getting 1 year probation for both of those separate cases. And I get out of jail and I have this, again, this, like, desire to, like, not do the same things and to change my life and to be a good person and to become part of my daughter's life again. And I get out of jail and I make it 8 hours. 8 hours and I'm back to doing the same old stuff. And you know, when I'm on probation and parole and they're like, oh, you need to do this, this, and this. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And I have every intention of doing that stuff, right? But once I pick up, all those intentions go out the window. And I can't do any of that stuff. You know, I obviously can't show up for a drug test because I'm going to fail. I can't go for evaluations because they're going to know. You know, I can't go to counseling because they're going to tell on me. So I just run. And, you know, another situation where, like, you know, God kicked him in the ass, like, so I'm on the run, I'm living in this kid's house in a different county, we're working for somebody under the table, and we're doing landscaping. We stop to put the tarp over the back of the dump truck in a giant parking lot. As we pull out of the parking lot, the brake light flickers, right? Cops pull us over. So the kid driving the car doesn't have his license on him, and the cops are like, where's yours? And of course, I know I'm on the run. I'm like, oh, I don't have it. And they're like, what's that wallet right there? Well, I have no idea, sir, you know? So they pull it out, read my name, cuff me, boom, back in jail I go. And you know, I do what I always do. I always call my mom and dad, try to get them to bail me out. And I call my mom to tell her I'm back in jail. And she says to me, she's like, you know, I'm glad you're in jail because now when we hear the cops drive by, we know it's not you in the back of the car. And when we hear the ambulance, we know it's not you. And we're not afraid now we're going to get a call from the morgue saying they found you dead. You know, and again, like, you think that that would do something to change me. But at the time, I was like, yeah, whatever. Can you get me some soups? And I hung up, you know. And you know, so this time I'm in a therapeutic community in jail, right? And that's a blast, you know? So I do the same thing that I've done in rehabs and everything, man. Like, I put on this face, I pretend I'm doing all the right stuff. I listen to the people that are seemingly successful, and I do what they do. And, you know, I get out of this thing after, like, 7 months, which is funny because I got 7 months on a violation for charges that don't even carry jail time. I just can't stay sober long enough to stay out of jail, you know? And, so I get out after 7 months, and again, man, I have this earnest desire. I'm going to stop. Everything's going to be different, man. This time, I only last 4 hours. And, you know, I abstained long enough to get into a recovery house, and then I started doing the same old thing all over again. I'm living in a recovery house in South Bethlehem, walking 2 blocks to people whose house I was in jail with and doing what I do. And what ends up happening is, you know, in another one of these situations, I go to the gas station to buy a pack of cigarettes one night, and what do you know, I run into one of the guys that lives in the house, right? And he's like, are you on something, you know? And I'm like, no, I'm fine, you know, like, drooling all over myself, can't even keep my eyes open, nah, I'm good, man, you know? And I end up having to move out of that house, and this was on a Friday, and I had to go see my PO on Tuesday, and for some reason, you know, I didn't want to run anymore. And I emailed one of the counselors that I had in the therapy community. I told him what happened. I called the PO on Monday. But in the back of my mind, I was like, I'm still going to jail. So I'm still going to continue to do what I'm doing up until that point, and then I'll change after that. So I go to see this PO on Tuesday. And before I went to see her, I had an interview for a job, right? And I thought I was going to jail anyway. I didn't even think I was going to go get the job, so I wasn't going to go, and something told me, you know what, might as well go. So I go, I get this job on the spot, I'm supposed to start the following Monday, and then I go see this PO, and she's like, you know, in all the time I've known you, which I think at this point was like 3 years on a one-year probation, and she's like, you've never once told me the truth. She's like, since you told me the truth, I'm going to give you one more chance. You know, like, and I wish I had some, like, glorious story about the last day, but realistically, all I did was enough to make me okay, and then I went to see my PO, right? And that was July 15th. And so what ends up happening is that guy who was all happy and smiling and who I couldn't stand that I met before, I call that guy up. And I'm like, look, man, like, I have no idea what to do. All I know is that everything that I've tried hasn't worked. So I'm willing to do whatever it is that you suggested me to do. And, you know, and we start going through the steps again. And, like, there's a couple things that in the beginning, like, I wasn't really clear about, right? Like, when it talks about powerlessness and unmanageability, I was always under the impression that I was only powerless and my life was only unmanageable when I was actively drinking or using, right? Apparently, that's incorrect. You know, like, the other side to powerlessness is that when I try to put it down, like, I don't know how long it's going to be until some situation will arise that will make it seem like a good idea again. You know, and same with the unmanageability. Like, I don't know about anyone else in this room, but when I just put the drink down and I don't do anything to change the person that I am, my life is super unmanageable. I can't even do things like normal people. Like, just paying bills and stuff like that is overwhelming to me. So that's like the powerlessness and unmanageability. And then, you know, when it comes to the second step, coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves, like, and the whole part about being restored to sanity, like, first of all, you know, like, I had to admit that first there was something wrong. You know, like, I wasn't necessarily willing to admit that, like, I was insane, but I was definitely, like, delusional. And I remember when I went to the healthcare rehab, and they're like, well, would you want somebody taking care of your family member in your condition? And I was like, are they as good as I am? You know, like, that was my attitude, you know, and that's completely delusional. Like, and, like, the same thing with the acid story, like, who does that? You know what I mean? Like, who goes to Burger King like that, let alone taking care of people, you know? Like, that's crazy. So anyway, like, you know, it's like, all right, man, like, you know, I can believe that maybe there's something greater than me that could help restore the sanity, right? And then when it comes to the third step, like, so I'm making a decision. First of all, I was like, are we in our lives? Like, what does that even mean? You know, like, I'm like, hey, God, can you come take this from me? Let me hand it over. Like, I you know, I picture this, like, actual physical transaction, and that's really not the case. You know, it's not like the dope man on the corner. But anyway, so, like, you know, what my sponsor told me was, like, he's like, look, man, like, the will in our lives is our thoughts and our actions, right? And the way in which you begin to do this stuff is to go through the rest of the steps, you know? But it talks about in the book about being God's employee, agent, and child, right? Like, first of all, I was like, God, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know about this, but at the point in which I came in, like, I pretty much exhausted all other options. So I was kind of willing to believe in this whole God thing because I had nothing left. Like, I've tried every sort of mix and match of chemicals, like, to live my life, and none of them ever worked. You know, it always got to the point where it was a mess again. So, like, I was like, all right, you know, maybe this, you know, maybe God will work. And then also I looked at my sponsor, right, and on paper he's a much bigger scumbag than I am, you know, and, like, his life is really good. So whatever his God is, it must be working for him. So maybe I'll just borrow that in the interim until I find one that I can understand better, you know? And I know at least up in where I'm from, like Bethlehem Lehigh Valley, a lot of times I used to hear people talking about, like, the four step, like it's this big thing, like, dun dun dun, the four step, you know? And like, you know, it's pretty easy. You know, like it says in the book, like, exactly what you do, and you sit down and you fill out these columns, and, like, it's really not that bad. And you know, like, the one part I guess that was somewhat difficult is when you're going through the last column and it's like my part, and I'm like, wait a minute here, you know, like, I didn't have any part in this. But, like, really what it helped to do is show me, like where I was at fault, because a lot of the things in my life that, like, I was resentful about were a direct result of my own actions, you know? And I guess I kind of talked about five with that too, going over that with my sponsor. And, you know, six and seven, like, there's really each a paragraph in the big book. You know, there's really not too much to talk about. They don't even talk about it a lot, you know? But so, like in terms of that, like, the beginning, just the beginning of that, like, like, my defects of character and my shortcomings, right? Like, I can turn them over to God because I kind of figured out what they were in four and five. But it's really on God's time as to when they're gonna go. You know, and, like, sometimes my defects of character and my shortcomings can be beneficial to other people. So God won't always take them away right away. And, it's on, like I said, it's on God's time. And, with the eight-step list, that stuff was pretty much transferred all the people from four, and then added people that I owed amends to that I didn't have any resentment towards. And, you know, I kind of drug my feet a little bit on this because, like, if you do eight, then you have to do nine. And I wasn't really all about doing nine. But, you know, like, I also didn't want to suffer anymore. You know, I didn't want to be that same scumbag. You know, like, I wanted to be a person that, like, could just be a regular member of society again. And so I make this list, and, you know, going on to nine, making amends, like, you know, I still have people on my amends list, and I still have financial amends. But just one amends that I'll share real quick. My grandparents moved to South Carolina the year that I was born, and they lived down there pretty much my entire life. And they moved back up here, I want to say 2010, 2011, and my grandfather died when I was in jail. And then my grandmother, like, she was on her way out, and just so happens that, you know, that I was able to get sober, you know, like a year before she did. And you know, part of my direct amends was that, I mean, part of my living amends was that I had to go visit her on a regular basis. And I tried to give her money and she wouldn't take it, so me and my sponsor decided every time I would go see her, I'd bring her flowers, you know. And so I went and I sat with this lady who I barely knew because she lived so far away my entire life. And you know, I go to make amends to her, and I find out that my aunt had like similar issues as me, and my grandmother had been a member of Narnon for like 9 years, and that she had known this whole time exactly what was going on with me. And you know, she ended up dying last August, right? And I was the last person to have like a coherent conversation with her, you know, which is crazy. Like, here's this like scumbag black sheep of the family, yet I'm the one there holding her hand as she dies. You know, and that's only through this program. You know, like, I never would have been there before. In fact, when I was out there, I went to visit her on, you know, just a robber. You know, like, that's the kind of guy I was. And, you know, here I am holding this woman's hand as she's dying. You know, it's crazy. And the 10th step, like, it's pretty clear-cut directions. You know, it's like, if these four things happen, do these four things, right? But see, like, if you're like me, I'm like, yeah, I'm good. You know, I don't want to do those things. And what happens is, like, sometimes I have to suffer a little bit until I'm willing to like, follow the outline, you know? And it's not even that hard. It's like, you know, talk to someone about it immediately, ask God, make amends if necessary, and turn your focus to someone you can help, you know, which is pretty much, like, how I'm supposed to live my life anyway. You know, but sometimes I'm unwilling to do it. Like, step 11, saw through prayer and meditation. And like I said, when I first came in here, like, I really was not all about God. And, you know, like, what ended up happening was, like, little by little, I started doing these things, and things began to change. And then I'm like, you know what, like, there's pretty concrete evidence that whatever that this thing is that I'm talking to is working in my life. So maybe I should continue to do that. And now it's like, I run into situations where something will happen, and like, my first reaction is to pray. And I'm like, who the, you know, like, where did that come from? And it's just, it's crazy how it works. And then the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So like that first part of it right there pretty much sums up like what this program's all about. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So that says to me there, if I do these steps, right, I will have a spiritual awakening. And that's what I'm looking for in order to solve the alcohol problem, right? So ergo, if I do these steps, it'll solve the alcohol problem. It seems like so complex, but it's really simple. So try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And, you know, like, the way that I ended up with my first sponsee is I was at a meeting with my sponsor, and this kid walked up and he's like, hey, can you be a sponsor? And in my head, I'm like, nah, you know? And my sponsor steps in, he's like, yes, he can, you know? I'm like, and I'm like, man. So, you know, I end up sitting down with this guy and going through the book. Like, the one thing my sponsor kind of drilled into me is, like, I'm responsible for my part, I'm not responsible for the results. You know, like, it's just my job to put a person's hand in the hand of God, and that's it. And then, you know, and anything that happens is not my fault. Like, I don't have the power to get anyone sober. Like, I don't have the power to get anyone drunk either. You know, but all I can do is show them what was shown to me. And it was practicing the principles on my affairs. That's, like, a little tough. And, like, you know, I could have all sorts of excuses. You know, like, I work right now as a commercial roofer, right? So, like, we don't really practice spiritual principles in commercial roofing. You know, usually, you know, I guess the best way I can describe it is kind of like an FU job. Like, we don't, you know, come in and say good morning. We're like, hey, FU, you know? And so, like, it's kind of hard to practice these principles, right? But like, the way in which I can do that today is, like, showing up for work when I'm supposed to show up, you know, and doing the things that I'm supposed to do, like being an employee today. And, you know, like, this program, when I first heard it and I first heard all this stuff about God and I first heard this stuff about the 12 steps, you know, I was like, man, how does that even, doesn't even make sense? It doesn't make rational sense. Like, how is me sitting down and talking about my faults with another person and going to stop me from drinking? That doesn't even make sense. And you know, I had a lot of like misconceptions, right? And you know, a lot of meetings they read the 9-step promises, but on my way they just call them the promises, right? There's a lot more promises than just that. But you know, like they would say, "Oh yeah, these are the promises," and they'd read them, and I'd be sitting in these meetings drinking the coffee and eating cookies, coming late and leaving early, and wondering why I'm not getting these things in my life, right? Because I was completely unaware that they're the 9-step promises. And unless I do all the work up to and including the 9th step, I don't get them. You know, like that doesn't become part of my life. And you know, and I didn't realize that. And as a result, I would come in, I would be absolutely miserable. I would get to the point where I either wanted to kill myself or kill somebody else, and I would go back to what I knew works. I would go back to what would take those thoughts and that pain away. And you know, and I did that for years, right? And even when I had like my first taste of like sobriety, we'll call it, you know, like actually doing the work and like getting some results, like as soon as my life cleared up like externally, I was like, oh, I don't got to do this stuff anymore, you know. And as a result, I went back to what I know. And you know, in this time that I've been sober, like some really crazy things have happened. You know, like when I was sitting in that jail cell, you know, I had my daughter, and you know, I hadn't seen her in like 2 years, right? And I never thought I'd see her again. Never thought I'd see her again. And, you know, at 6 months over, I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, pray about it. And you know, I made a phone call to her mom, who actually answered the phone, surprisingly. And, you know, I had to go to some, like, counseling and stuff in order to be a part of her life. But, like, as a result, you know, I got to see my daughter for the first time, you know, and it was crazy. And, like, this little girl who, you know, I wasn't around from the time she was 3 till 5, so like she has no recollection of me whatsoever. And you know, now I have her every other weekend. You know, and she sleeps over, and it's like it's crazy. Like you can just tell by the way that she looks at me and reacts to me, like how much she loves me. You know, like I don't know if anyone has kids in here, but like just that feeling when they curl up in a ball under your arm and fall asleep, man, that's some powerful stuff. You know, and you know, and I never thought that'd be possible. And you know, like my parents who obviously I robbed their house when they were on vacation, you know, they actually let me come there, and they gave me a key to the house and the security code. You know, like that's crazy. Like I would never do that, you know? And you know, like they trust me to be in their house when they're not there. You know, like my parents growing up, they had a deadbolt on the door to their bedroom, you know, because I would just steal whatever. I would just steal whatever because I had to get what I had to get, and I didn't care what was in my way. You know, I had blatant disregard for anyone else's life and or safety. You know, all I cared about was myself. And, you know, like, I don't know, man, like, this, like, recovery stuff, like, you know, even with all that external stuff, which, you know, is all well and good, like, that's not really the best part of sobriety. You know, like, the best part of sobriety is, like, that gnawing voice in the back of my head that's always telling me, like, I'm not good enough, or I'm different, or I'm crazy, or whatever. Like that thing's gone for the most part. You know, it comes back here and then, but, like, you know, like, I have actual contentment. You know, like, I can enjoy my life for what it is. And, you know, I can be a son to my parents, and a sibling to my siblings, and a father to my daughter, you know, and, like, my life is really good. And even when I'm in situations that before, like, my first reaction would have been to go right back to what I know. Like, I have the ability to you know, to pray to God and to get through them. You know, and, like, in the book it talks about nothing ensures this immunity from the next drink as intensive work with another alcoholic, right? And I found that true so many times. Like, all the times where, like, I was up in my own head or worried about situations that I was currently in or the future or anything, like, the minute I reach my hand out and I start trying to help someone else with their problems, like, my problems seem so much smaller, you know? And a lot of times, like, the things that I'm worried about have a way of working themselves out, right? And my sponsor uses this analogy, and I think it's really stupid, but it kind of makes sense now, so I'll share it. He's like, you know, say you're playing with this Rubik's Cube, you know? And, you know, you get the green side, and then you get the blue side, and then you go to get the yellow side, and you mess up the green, and you mess up the blue. And then you got this guy over here, and he's playing with a Rubik's Cube. So you put yours down, and you go over, and you start helping him with his Rubik's Cube, and you come back, and yours is put together, right? And that's kind of how, like, God works in my life. Like, when I When I stop being so selfish and self-centered and I concentrate on helping other people, like, things in my life just have a way of working themselves out, you know, without me really doing much except trying to help other people. And just end with this, like, you know, Jeff mentioned the thing about young people in AA, and, like, the other thing that I did this time that I never really did before was get involved with service, right? And, like, partially I didn't do before because I was selfish and self-centered. I didn't want to give up my time, right? But this time it was like I was willing to do whatever it took, you know, for me to get this. And the one thing I never did was, like, was be of service. You know, like, I would refuse to make coffee. Even though I would drink it, I still wouldn't make it. You know, some people are like, oh, I don't drink coffee. Well, I did drink it, but I still wasn't going to make it. And people would ask me to chair meetings, and I'm like, sure. And I would chair meetings because I was in control. I could sit up there with the hammer and call on who I wanted to talk and all this stuff, right? But I would never do things, like, for selfless reasons. So I go to this election for this committee, and what it was is a big committee to try to get the State Conference of Young People in Bethlehem. And, you know, they're going through the positions, and they read this one position, and nobody stands for it, right? And, like, I look around, and I don't know why, but something in there is just like, you know what, you should volunteer for this, so I volunteer for this position. And, you know, as a result, like, you know, this will be our third year, and now we have the conference coming to Bethlehem. And like that's crazy. Like, you know, like, even intergroup and, like, district, like, you go there and, like, you got a lot of egos in the room. Like, imagine that, but, like, pretty much everyone's under 25, you know? Like, it's like a lot worse, man. And everyone always wants to be right, and everyone thinks they're right, and it's like a mess. But it's a whole lot of fun, man. And it definitely taught me how to grow. And, you know, it talks about how love and tolerance of others is our code, right? And that's, like, definitely of prime importance, especially when involved in service. You know, because I don't have love and tolerance, man. Like, it's definitely get real irritated and angry. But anyway, I guess, like, in closing, you know, it's like when I came in here the first couple times and I saw all this stuff, you know, I was absolutely certain that it wouldn't work for me, right? This last time I came in, I was also certain that it wasn't going to work for me, right? But I did it anyway. And as a result now, like my life is completely different than it was. You know, like, I don't have to worry about the sheriffs coming and kicking down my door anymore. You know, like, I get to spend time with my family and with my daughter. You know, I've been blessed with a relationship, although sometimes it's trying, especially when it's someone else in the program, you know, it's definitely worthwhile. And, you know, like, I can't imagine life any other way, you know, and the only cost is that I got to continue to do the things that I was shown in the beginning. That's all I got. Thanks.